Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to the Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Kaplan Lombardi restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. And we're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Good morning, Mark.
Hey, Francis.
How are you this morning?
I'm doing good, man.
I saw the thing that you left on my desk this morning, which was the article.
The thing.
What was the article? On beer tales, beer cocktails. And I thought that was very interesting. There seems to be a growing interest in mixing beer with beverages or with other alcoholic beverages and making cocktails where beer is a component.
It's all part of the cocktail craze, I think, and we're going to obviously talk a little bit more about that with the mighty Ted Haig in a little while.
Yeah, Ted Haig is joining us later on. Ted Haig, also known as Dr. Cocktail, is probably the foremost cocktail historian on the planet. He's a great, funny, fun, and interesting guy, and he's got a great new book out. It's about lost cocktails that, you know, you don't see around very much anymore and how to make them. And we know a lot about cocktails, and some of these were like, look at that. You know, things I'd heard of and never seen recipes for. Mm-hmm. So I think that's really good. We're going to have fun talking with him later. But we're probably not going to talk with him about beer cocktails.
Why don't you think we're going to talk about beer?
Let's trace this back a little bit. In we don't mix beer with alcoholic beverages except in
rarely,
this country.
Rarely, every once in a while,
Boilermaker,
what was the champagne and Guinness?
Black Velvet.
Black Velvet.
Yeah.
You know, things like that. We do mix occasionally with beer.
When's the last time you served a Black Velvet?
Never.
14 years ago for me.
I think I poured one once just to see what it tasted like.
It was gross.
And then I went, ew, and I never did it again.
But actually, mixing beer with other things has a history, mm-hmm. and you'll get in Ireland and England, people will start the day with a shandy,
mm-hmm.
and a shandy is and if you can try this, it's actually pretty good. Works best with tap beer and with a hoppy kind of a beer like a Harp.
Mm-hmm.
But in England, you'll take a little lemon soda. Here you can take 7-Up. It doesn't work quite as well. It's a little corn syrup beer or 7-Up. But you put in just a couple of ounces on the bottom, maybe 2-3 ounces of soda on the bottom of a pint glass, and then fill it up with Harp, and that's called a shandy.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very good. And actually, in research for the Kaplan Lombardi cocktail list, I came across the origins of the shandy. The shandy was actually used to be called a shandy gaff. And it was 50% ginger ale, which, of course, back in those days had
ginger in it. That would have been one of the key ingredients of ginger ale that no longer is an ingredient in ginger ale.
And it was half ginger ale and half Harp or some sort mm-hmm. of a lager. And then it had like a shot of something in it, like orange curacao or something. It was really, yeah, I think it was orange curacao. And
I made a grossy face at Francis.
I tried to make one. It wasn't very good. But you bring up an excellent point. Ginger ale had ginger in it.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that you can do is make, if you want to make great cocktails, is try and avoid using commercial sodas.
Mm-hmm.
And if a cocktail calls for a commercial soda to be put in it, you need to be very careful, because an ingredient that really will mess up your cocktail is high fructose corn syrup.
Yeah, remember that when a lot of these cocktails, even the ones that call for ginger ale or things like that, were invented in the 30s or the 20s or earlier even, that's not what soda was.
Right.
And soda didn't have high fructose corn syrup in it.
Right. Your ginger ale would have ginger, and so it would have some ginger flavor. It would have heat, and the sweetness would come from sugar. And I can't stress to you having worked with cocktails in our own bar a lot over the last 6 months or so, the addition of a splash of anything that has high fructose mm-hmm. corn syrup in it will change the texture of your drink, will make it more cloying. And you know what? Since most of us are used to drinking drinks that are mostly high fructose corn syrup
mm-hmm.
Driven, that's where the sweetness comes from, you may not notice it. But when you make a drink without it, you will see.
How clean it is, and I guess that's the best word I could describe.
Absolutely.
Is the cocktails are clean. They leave your mouth, and they leave your mouth tasting refreshed instead of kind of sticky and craving more corn syrup.
And there are some high-end ginger beers that are out there that ginger beers and ginger ales. Read the ingredients. Turn it over, and if it has high fructose corn syrup on it, you don't want it in your cocktail. And people make their own ginger beer and their own tinctures and their own bitters. And if you want to make your own ginger beer, you can. Better to do it with soda and, you know, boil a bunch of ginger with spices, et cetera, and so forth, and get yourself the flavor that you need to make a quality product like that. But, Mark, you're the beer guy. I'm the wine guy. What do you think about beer tails?
Well, I think they could be interesting. I think if you use the right kind of beer and the right kind of ingredients, you know, this ingredient that was in Jonathan Miles' column in the New York Times, the Griot, I think has it some interesting components. It's got a cherry-infused Belgian ale, and it's served with cherry herring and kirsch. And I think it could be a decent cocktail. I haven't actually tried it yet. We need to head out there, I think, and test these out.
Yeah, the guy who came up with it is Aviram Turgeman. It's his signature cocktail at Café d'Alsace, which opened last month. It's on the Upper East Side, and Mr. Turgeman is New York's first self-proclaimed beer sommelier. I like that.
The beer sommelier, I know, exactly.
And he puts great beer together with great food at the restaurant. Mm-hmm. I think it's fabulously interesting. I want to go there.
You know, I do think it's interesting, but in fairness, there are a lot of people who have been doing that kind of beer, combining beer with food for a long time. For instance, the country of Belgium.
Yes, but in this country, you know, we don't understand, like, the beer and food together the way wine and food goes together, that there's so many different kinds of beer, especially Belgian and European beers that have so many different flavors that, you know, you drink differently depending on what you're eating.
I remember back in the late 80s, there was a guy named Chris, and I can't remember his last name right now for the life of me, but he worked at a place called the Old Bay in New Brunswick.
Yes.
And it, you know, he really made, this was a true restaurant. It still exists, a kind of Cajun Creole style restaurant, but beer was the focal point of the restaurant, where most of the restaurants you see today and even back then were much more wine centric in what they paired with their cuisine. Back then, they decided, the Old Bay in New Brunswick decided, that beer went better with their food than wine, and they focused their whole beverage program on having these really awesome beers from these really little known producers, and they were kind of at the front of that whole microbrewery craze in the early to mid 80s.
That was the same place that the owner, when we had this whole anti-French thing, he poured. Mm-hmm. He's like, I'm pouring all of the French wine in my cellar down the toilet.
Of course, he only had one.
He had two bottles of Dom Perignon, and he made national news by pouring his French wine collection down the toilet. The two bottles of Dom Perignon.
But I think that pairing, and we had Garrett Oliver on the show from Brooklyn Brewery recently. Pairing beer and food is an interesting, twist on where we are right now, where everybody thinks that it should always be wine, especially with spicy food and things like that. And I think that's why the Cajun Creole combination from the Old Bay came about. With spicy food, you know, there are some beers that are just awesome with it.
Yeah, and here we have Anheuser-Busch and the big companies are getting in on this, because beer sales among those kind of big beers have been flat. With sales flat and profits sputtering, Anheuser-Busch is surfing the cocktail wave with creations like the Orangutang, Bud Light, and Orange Juice.
That sounds gross.
Best served to an orangutan. Or the B to E bomb, which Budweiser's caffeinated offshoot is spiked with Jägermeister, and quite appropriately, it says here in the Times, a mixture destined for a favorite drink status in the basement of fraternity houses, which is exactly where
it
belongs.
You know what? I have no problem with Budweiser trying to get into this marketplace, but maybe there's a different
way to do it. Maybe they should hire us. We'll come up with a cocktail.
There you go.
Anyway, we'll be back in just a moment talking with Ted Haig, the Dr. Cocktail, about the history of American Cocktails. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:15. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. Mark Pascal is at Shauna Stage Left and Captain Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick, New Jersey. Our guest today is Ted Haig. Ted's a renowned and highly respected historian of the American cocktail. He made a big splash back in the 90s as the spirits maven for America Online. He's also known as Dr. Cocktail. He's been quoted on the subject in publications like the New York Times, Esquire, the Malt Advocate, Men's Journal, my particular favorite. His new book, Vintage Spirits and Forgotten Cocktails, is a particularly fun take on a particularly fun part of history. It's an homage to the great bartenders of the past and what some call the golden age of the American cocktail. Ted, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Hey, Ted, how are you today?
I'm fabulous.
Now, what was the golden age of the American cocktail and what made it the golden age?
Interesting question.
That's my job. I'm a radio guy.
It's your job an hour a day, anyway.
Right, yeah.
Well, as they say, souffle. Anyway, the golden age was not the beginning. Back in the beginning, the cocktail was considered very, very bad form indeed.
Really?
Yes, and I'll get into that. But to answer your question, the golden age probably would have begun in the 1880s, the Gilded Age, where bars got long and lots of brass and velvet wallpaper and bartenders who were making really complicated drinks indeed, the days of the nine-level pousse cafes, extending right up to Prohibition, and then Prohibition, which was intended to kill the cocktail, instead gave it a new lease on life, and it continued in its sort of guerrilla form. And as American bartenders fled there to pursue their craft, right up until the end of Prohibition, into the 1930s, still looking good. World War II and the alcohol rationing of that created a situation where the distilleries were looking to do something else. They went to highball, and that was the end of the Golden Age.
Now, what do you mean when they went to the highball? What
okay.
Describe
what happened was, what America really liked to drink from almost the colonial era up was aged American whiskey. It's what they favored. And first, World War I had alcohol rationing. Then, immediately on its heels, Prohibition severely curtailed the amount of alcohol that was produced. And we must remember here that there were some distilleries licensed under the National Prohibition Act to make medicinal alcohol, which was essentially pints of whiskeys that your doctor could prescribe with special prescription.
It was a good time to be friends with a doctor, I guess.
Legend had it.
Watch himself.
Legend had it in the Irish neighborhood of Orange, where my family comes from. I had several uncles who were quite ill most of the time.
Doctor, I have a crick in my neck.
That's right. It's neuralgia.
Right.
Here, have some rum.
Yeah. So. So what's a highball that then cocktails turned over to highballs?
Right. So what happened is they were running out of aged whiskey because of all these things, Prohibition, and then World War II, and the distilleries were almost panicking. They were saying, "Man, what are we going to do? Let's market blended whiskey. That way we can add like 80% grain neutral spirits to whiskey. We'll have a lot more. And then let's just have them put it in a tall glass with sparkling water. That's your highball." And this led to vodka and to everything else we've seen since, right up through the dark era of the 1970s, where even martinis and Manhattan were on the rocks.
And don't forget disco.
Okay, so my favorite.
Quite the dark era. I think people, Ted, don't realize what whiskey was like back in the late 1800s and the early 1900s. I think people don't realize that how wonderful those aged whiskeys were.
That's right.
Can you tell us a little bit about how they were made? And
sure. The whiskeys back then, the one thing you really need to know is they were stronger. What everybody wanted was bonded whiskey, and by bonded I mean by law it had to be stored in a government bonded warehouse for at least 4 years, and it had to be exactly 100 proof. So this was a strong, aromatic, potent whiskey. But that's what people were used to, and they loved it. And you know, since those days, we've seen whiskey get pretty bad, and lower in proof and lower in proof. And now it's never come back to that. But there's still a large number of 90 proof whiskeys out there, and right now is as good as whiskey's been since Prohibition.
And I think a lot of our listeners may not have ever gotten the chance to taste one of those pre-prohibition whiskeys.
Oh, they're
and
wonderful.
They are cognac-like. I mean,
yeah,
they are.
It's incredible. We recently...
mean, in my case, I have to say, when I was young and extra stupid, one of my first terrible drunken hungover incidents was on a bottle of Early Times, and I did not touch whiskey for 15 years after that.
How sad.
But somebody showed me a bottle of a whiskey kind of hilariously called Bourbon Deluxe, but in fact it was. And it was distilled in 1916 and bottled in 1936.
Yeah.
And I looked at him and I said, sure, I'll try some of that. Mm-hmm. And I did, and it's just like you said, it's cognac-like.
And it's a revelation, and then Ted Haig went on to be known as Dr. Cocktail. His current book is Vintage Spirits and Forgotten Cocktails. It's an awesome book, and you know what Eggheads Mark and I are about cocktails and things like that. It's a great piece of history. It's visually appealing, and it's a piece of history that you can get your hands dirty and make some of these cocktails. We'll be talking more with Ted in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 1125.
The place, Brooklyn, New York, post-World War II. An Italian-American woman named Kathleen Lombardi cooks for her family. What's so special about that? Well, lots. Food was central back then. Good food handed down from the traditions of two countries. Food that filled the whole house with the sweet smells of garlic, tomato, and basil. No matter when you stopped by or who you were sure to be fed and fussed over. Kathleen showed her love on the plate and out of the pot. Any who were lucky enough to receive it never forgot. This is Mark Pascal from the Restaurant Guys Radio Show and Stage Left. I've just opened Kathleen Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, and its mission, to live up to the standards set by Kathleen Lombardi. So come by the bar, sit by the fire. Have some fresh mozzarella and antipasto. The manicotti and tortelloni are amazing, and the veal chop will make you cry. Our wine list, of course, without parallel. We've got to live up to the standards set by Kathleen Lombardi. You see, Kathleen Lombardi was my grandmother. Come let me show you where I came from.
Kathleen Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, 732-296-9463 or KatherineLombardi.com. Hey, everybody, welcome back. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys, Francis and Mark. Our guest is Ted Haig. He is Dr. Cocktail. His new book is called Vintage Spirits and Forgotten Cocktails, and you need to pick it up. You can find out how to do that by going to our website, restaurantguysradio.com, and we'll link you to it and all sorts of information about Dr. Cocktail and his many websites and his great work with cocktails. Your book is a history of the cocktail. It's also a great cocktail recipe book for cocktails people may not find elsewhere, and I think that's amazing.
Exactly.
We were talking about whiskey before and how things turned over from the golden age of the cocktail, which was sort of were whiskey-based and aromatic and flavorful cocktails, to today vodka-based,
right,
colorful candy things.
Yep.
You write in your book, and really struck me, you said that as consumers we have a certain responsibility, and one of the things that you bemoan is that as consumers in America, we've lost our ability to, or lost placing a value on the ability to gain acquired tastes. Can you talk to us about that?
Definitely. I mean, there's a lot of blame to go around. I mean, the distillers, they don't care.
You're on The Restaurant Guys. We're not afraid to assign blame.
Perfect. Anyway, the distillers, you know, they just want to sell their product. And if they're going to do cocktails, if cocktails are the big thing, they're going to mix a cocktail that they're going to get the most people to like. What do they do? They make it sweet. They make it fruity. They hide the tang of alcohol. There has been at least one generation in this country brought up to like that very thing.
Mm-hmm.
So, to me, this is an invitation to alcoholism.
Right.
Well, you know, I just want to clarify, because we only have a minute left in the segment, and I want to come back to it after the news. But, you know, people may be listening and think, oh, well, there must be alcoholics. They want the drink to taste like alcohol. And that's not exactly there's a counterintuitive thing going on here.
No, it's quite the opposite. I
right.
mean, to make it something that only an adult would like, I mean, my litmus paper is, would a child like it?
Right.
And
mm-hmm.
if a child would like it, that's when I say it's an invitation to alcoholism.
It shouldn't be candy.
You know, it's funny. One of the current drinks, more modern drinks that I do like is a Cosmopolitan. But I saw a man drinking a Cosmopolitan while eating a steak in the restaurant the other night.
That's so wrong.
I was like, you're 29. What are you doing with the pink drink and your steak? We'll be back in a moment. We're talking with Ted Haig. His book is Vintage Spirits and Forgotten Cocktails. We'll be talking more with him after the news.
And remember, your steak should be pink, not your drink.
Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:30.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcasts on iTunes.
Ted Haig is a renowned and highly respected historian of the American cocktail. He's been quoted on the subject in publications like the New York Times, Esquire, The Malt Advocate. His new book is Vintage Spirits and Forgotten Cocktails. It's a particularly fun and well-written book from one of the top experts in the field. Mark and I love it and are going to make some cocktails from it at our restaurant if you want to come down to Catherine Lombardi. It should take me a week or so to get them in, but I really fell in love with a couple of those cocktails. Hey, Ted, when you looked at sort of resurrecting forgotten cocktails, and we are in the dawn of another, I don't know if it's another golden age, but it's at least a renaissance of cocktails in America.
Exactly so.
What was your guiding principle for what was included in this book?
Well, first of all, I mean, this book, in a sense, took years to write. In fact, it was written in just under a year, but it was the years of, I mean, this book started out to be this giant tome back in when I first decided I wanted to write a book. But then it became so daunting, it was sort of dead in the water. When Rockport Press came to me and wanted me to do this book,
mm-hmm.
it was at a funny time. I was working on the biggest film in Hollywood. I just bought a house. I'd just gotten married. I was renovating the house, and they want me to write a book.
Mm-hmm.
So, but they said, you know, it's just going to be a few recipes, just a little bit of text in there.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was like, yeah, I could do that. And then they were like, and we're going to call something like New Kiki Cocktails. And I was like, and they said, but we'll tailor it to you. And I said, okay, well, then that concept's entirely out.
Right.
So I do, and of course, it expands into a much bigger thing because I couldn't just do a little bit of text. Like, I wanted it to be a serious thing. So packed in this small book is just all this information. And to specifically answer your question, the drinks were, many of them were accumulated loves of mine. And I, like you guys, am somewhat of an iconoclast in that I don't want to do what everybody else just does.
Mm-hmm.
I want to go for the different stuff. I want to go, were there other good drinks that we're not drinking now? Why aren't they being drunk anymore? What's the deal?
And how do you find these things? I mean, are they gone? Do you find them in books? How do you find them?
Yes, books and newspapers. I've got a very large collection of antique bar guides from the first one ever published to present.
Mm-hmm.
Well, one of the things that I want to explain to everybody, well, two things. One, that Ted Haig does this whole cocktail thing. I don't want to say on the side because it's become a full-time...
How about in addition to?
full-time gig for you, but he's also a graphic designer for feature movies. But Ted, Dale DeGroff, who is the greatest American bartender, living bartender, and probably the greatest bartender in the world, refers to you as the greatest... cocktail historian in the world.
And actually, what he says about your collection of old bar guides, I've heard it in legend. I want to come to your house and like sneak in. But Dale says that you have the most amazing collection of cocktail literature, period. And he has an amazing collection. I can only imagine what yours is all about.
I just have to say, I mean, I've got nowadays in the world of the internet, I have some stiff competition in terms of both cocktail historians and the other things too. David Wondrich, who's the drink maven for Esquire magazine, is wonderful.
And yep.
I mean, a conversation between us is going to make people's eyes roll up in their head so fast they'll get whiplash.
Right.
You know, it's just getting into the...
Let's just say it would be best to be drinking a cocktail while listening to you two.
That's right, yeah. Right. We do that, everything will be fine. and among bar literature, there's a guy named Brian Ray who really sort of created the beverage manager position from scratch.
Mm-hmm.
And he's, I think, got the biggest collection of these things. But what I do that they don't do is integrate all these bar books with all these bar bottles. I look at them. I try to figure out what the ingredients are, and then I try to find them. And I've got mm-hmm. ingredients that haven't been made in 100 years.
So you make ingredients?
No. I find them. I will ferret them out.
All right, here. Let me give you an example of something that I just saw in your book. I was amazed because I just read your book last night. And you use the same thing that I use. And I like to make a Brooklyn cocktail because we have a restaurant based on Marsh Grandmother, and one of the ingredients in there is Amer-Picon. And I know that Amer-Picon that you can buy, you know, is not – you can't get Amer-Picon like there was Amer-Picon back when the Brooklyn was popular.
That's right.
And you recommend using Torani Amer, which is, I mean, how did you find, because I don't know how I found it, but how did you find it?
This is actually really easy. I mean, because one of the great bastions for the pecan punch in California, where I live, is Bakersfield.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to be a little crazy to travel all the way to Bakersfield just to have a pecan punch, but that's what I did. And I met one guy there who was a former member of Devo who had done the same thing. So we iconoclasts have to stick together. Anyway, that's where I discovered Torani Amer because they couldn't get real Amer pecan either. I mean, first of all, Amer pecan went from something that was like 80 proof.
Right, now it's weak.
Something that's now like 16 or 32.
Even if you can get the American
right, it's like 16% alcohol, 32
that's
proof.
Right, exactly. And so, yes, and so even if you can get the real thing, and it's really hard to get that. I mean, I think the company in France is having some problems. So there's this American company who actually makes the Torani flavoring syrups but keeps this thing entirely segregated, not on the website or anything, makes this. And so what were the bartenders in Bakersfield, the ones expert in making pecan punch, and by the way, for your listeners, that's P-I-C-O-N, not like a pecan. And,
you know you're
anyway,
a little nutty, right?
That's
you know that, right?
More like a pecan.
Go ahead.
Anyway, that's what they were using. And I said, if that's what they're using, that's what I'm going to use. So there it was.
You know, it's funny because I thought the same thing. I was ripping my hair out because I wanted to make a Brooklyn because the whole thing is an Italian-American restaurant based on Mark's grandmother from Brooklyn, and I wanted a section called the Barrows, so I had a Manhattan, and I had a Bronx, and I needed a Brooklyn.
Yep.
And for Staten Island, we just take a bunch of garbage from the kitchen and put it in a glass.
In a blender.
In a blender, right, exactly. Now, that's for all my Staten Island listeners, I'm really sorry about that. The guy, is the pot calling the kettle black, the guy from Jersey making fun of Staten Island, right?
Well, you know.
Anyway, but you find it in the most unlikely sources, but the flavors are right on. You'd think it's a flavoring syrup company. It wouldn't be very high quality, but it is. Hey, now, let me ask, in your research, did you find drinks that were historically important, that were popular at one time, that are best left in the past?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, and one of them, this will be one of the few great props I give to vodka here, but the screwdriver, the simple screwdriver, was based on an earlier drink called an orange blossom. What was an orange blossom? Gin and orange juice. That's just disgusting. I mean, sometimes the future is brighter.
Yeah, yeah.
And well, by the way, Ted mentions vodka here. Not a big fan of vodka, are you?
Not really. I mean, actually, what I'm not a fan of is the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms definition of vodka.
Which is?
Which is it's supposed to be flavorless.
Mm-hmm.
When the best thing you can say about a spirit is how smooth it is, well, smoothness is highly overrated.
How little it tastes like anything.
That's right, exactly. Whereas some of the older styles of Russian vodka, like Zubrowka, Jarzebiak, and other strangely named such things, are wonderful. They're fabulous.
Ted, they're not that strangely named if you speak Russian.
Well, but with those things, are they good ingredients in cocktails, or are good vodkas best just drunk straight?
Well,
while wearing a fur hat?
I like to drink them straight, although there's this weird thing where you mix Zubrowka, which is flavored with a strain of bison grass, with apple juice. And I saw that, and I thought, that sounds disgusting. It isn't. It's wonderful. I mean,
really?
And this is something that they did historically, and it is wonderful. So sometimes you just never know, and there's a lot more future to the cocktail.
Well, you know, it's funny because I'm just trying to think of how you'd market that. I can see that on the cocktail menu, the bison grass and apple juice fizz.
Nice.
Not going to go. Hey, listen, when we come back, I want to talk about our new generation of cocktails, how to use these old cocktails in a new setting, and I want to talk with you about raw eggs. Can we do that? Super. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 1145. Hi, this is Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants and also of The Restaurant Guys radio show. You know, one of the best things about the restaurant business is the creative side of it. Coming up with big ideas and then turning those concepts into reality is awesome. It's what I love most about what I do. But it can't stop there. If you can't communicate exactly what it is you're doing, then you'll find yourself standing alone in your dining room, just you and your big ideas. The Mardini Group can help you get your ideas across to others. The Mardini Group is a boutique graphic design firm, and they do extraordinary work. We use them, and as you know, we only use the best. Whether it's menu design, product packaging, a corporate report, promo material, a homepage, or an awesome logo for a brand new project like Catherine Lombardi, we turn to the Mardini Group. Some small business owners don't realize how important it is to have a strong visual identity. Without it, you come across as less than professional. That can cost you trust, and that lowers your bottom line. First impressions count for a lot, and that's why you need the Mardini Group. Go to RestaurantGuysRadio.com and click on the Mardini Group link, or call them at 718-694-9944. The Mardini Group for graphic design, 718-694-9944. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You are listening to Mark and Francis of Catherine Lombardi and Stage Left Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick, New Jersey, and we're talking with Ted Haig about cocktails. Ted's book is Vintage Spirits and Forgotten Cocktails. You can link to it on our website, restaurantguysradio.com. And actually, these cocktails are so amazing in here, and there's such a history behind them. We're going to add a couple to our burgeoning cocktail list at Catherine Lombardi's bar. So if you want to come and try a few of them after you pick up the book and see if you got them right or not, you can come check them out with us. Now, Ted, we're coming up on a pretty important event and an organization that I know you're involved with. You've been involved with the Museum of the American Cocktail, which you can find links to that on our site. And you guys are celebrating what is may or may not be the 200th anniversary of the American Cocktail?
Nicely put.
Well, yeah. Well, elaborate.
Here's the deal.
Yeah.
The internet has changed everything about how knowledge is acquired historically. What happened is they're suddenly scanning all of these 19th and 18th century newspapers in digitally, and then they're performing on them a process called OCR, optical character recognition.
Mm-hmm.
This means you can search on the term cocktails. You can search a range of years, say 1800 to 1820, and it'll pick it up.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't have to read through these things anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So ever since the 1930s, the best known resources said the cocktail first saw print in May of 1806 in a Hudson, New York newspaper called the Balance and Columbian Repository. So
uh-huh.
We based the 200th anniversary of the cocktail this year on that. Well, in September of last year, Dr. David Wondridge, actually, who I mentioned before, discovered in a newspaper called the Farmer's Cabinet a reference to the cocktail in 1803.
Mm, so we missed it.
Moment. Well, except this was just a narrative. I woke up, had cocktail, you know,
uh-huh.
Went on down the street. That sort of thing. So, and that's all it said. So the 1806 date is still the first definition of the cocktail. We understand what a cocktail is as of this point. It may not have been. Nobody even suggested it was the birth of the cocktail because nobody really knows.
Mm-hmm.
We just know when it saw print and whether or not this earlier guy, you know, had adhered to what we think of as a cocktail based on the Balance and Columbian Repository definition
mm-hmm.
is anybody's guess.
Hmm.
So we don't mind letting it stay as the 200th anniversary of the cocktail debacle.
Plus the invitations have been printed.
I'm sorry?
Plus
yeah,
the invitations
exactly.
have been printed.
So how and where are we going to celebrate this?
There are two places. One is going to be at the main Museum of the American Cocktail, which currently resides in Las Vegas, at the Commander's Palace, in the Aladdin Casino shopping mall.
Nice.
It's a big room, and I custom designed display cases for the whole thing. It's going to be it's beautiful, and
okay.
The artifacts there are tons of them, and it's I mean you can literally like a timeline go from that 1806 date all the way around the room to the present.
And if you're interested in flying out to Vegas, or if you live near Vegas and you're listening to the podcast and you want to go, we're going to put up a link to our site to the Museum of the American Cocktail, or you can just go to the Museum of the American Cocktail website directly and find out about that. But you're also going to be in New York, right?
That's right. We're going to be at a venue called The Balance upstairs. And there, Dr. Wondridge has sort of captioned a smaller exhibit, but there are going to be some great personalities from the from liquor writing and bartending trades there,
and a couple radio show personalities.
Actually,
there,
that's
too.
Right, and media. And actually, yeah, and then that's going to be beautiful too. And I'd love to be in both places.
Well, you're going to be in Vegas, but we're actually, the restaurant guys are going to go attend the celebration in New York. We're going to bring our microphones and bring a little of that celebration to y'all out there listening in, on the radio and on the computer. So that should be a lot of fun.
Yeah, and talk to Dave Wondrich. He's a little devil.
Actually, I sat with Dave Wondrich on a vodka focus group that Dale put together with the folks from the Flatiron Lounge and Employees Only, which are two great cocktail bars in Manhattan. Recently, we sat on a vodka panel.
Funny they didn't invite me to that.
Well, you're all the way on the West Coast. It was put together by these people who are launching a vodka, and you know, real cocktailians are real cocktail bartenders are often accused of being anti vodka snobs.
And right. And Ted, by the way, virtual vodka tasting doesn't work as well.
Yeah. So we tasted, and the reason is because, you know, no bartender is ever really going to recommend a vodka, because frankly, it doesn't matter once you put it in the cranberry juice with the lime on it. You know, it doesn't matter that much.
Right.
And, you know, we sat down with these vodka people and these cocktail experts, and somehow I got included, I don't know how, but I was sitting next to David Wondrich, and we tasted eight vodkas blind, and their vodka did pretty well, and they asked us what our feedback was, and I said, well, your vodkas did very well, but it doesn't matter at all. Listen, what do you mean? It doesn't matter. People choose a vodka based on a magazine ad, and if you swapped out people's vodkas and put something different in the bottle, they wouldn't know.
Is it in a cool, frosty bottle?
Yeah, I mean, gin drinkers will know if you switch out their vodka. Whiskey drinkers will know if you give them the wrong whiskey.
But I have to ask.
Shoot.
Are you guys aware of a website called ohmygoditburns.com?
No. What's that?
Okay. This is the cool thing. These college kids took bottles of the worst rot gut vodka, the rawest thing, and poured them six times through a Brita filter.
Uh-huh.
Came out like Kettle One.
Oh, really?
Oh, nice.
Doesn't that tell you something?
That's nice. OhMyGodItBurns.com, and I think we just burned the Kettle One people here in just a moment. We'll be back in just a moment. We're talking with Ted Haig. He is Dr. Cocktail and author of Vintage Spirits and Forgotten Cocktails. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:55. Hey, everybody, welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. Mark and Francis of Stage Left, the Captain Lombardi restaurants in downtown New Brunswick. We're talking about cocktails. If you want to try some of these cocktails, I don't usually shamelessly plug our own restaurant on the show, but these cocktails you won't find very often in New Jersey anyway. There are a few places in New York. Our friend Audrey's place that we always talk about, the Pegu Club, is probably the center of gravity of cocktails in New York now, and hopefully the center of gravity of cocktails in New Jersey is going to be Captain Lombardi. We use an ingredient that... you know, real cocktailians use, we use raw egg whites. I mean, more properly, we coddle the eggs. But how important are raw eggs, and why? And are people justifiably afraid of them, or are they okay in drinks? What do you stand on raw eggs?
I believe in them, and I believe that, obviously, what people are worried about are bugs, are botulism, and so on and so forth.
Salmonella, sure.
Yeah, exactly. And the way to avoid that is you put the egg in first. You then put the high-proof liquor on top of it. Boom! It's dead. Even if there was something wrong with it. But with modern refrigeration, it's just not an issue. And you can get pasteurized eggs where there's no possibility of this if you look for them.
And the other thing is, if you want to be careful at home, well, what we do is you drop it in hot boiling water for 30 seconds, and then you're there. And you're done.
Coddled egg.
And you have a coddled egg.
Most of the salmonella, remember, is on the outside of the shell.
That's right. And really, but the other thing is, You get a lot of people not using them for other reasons. They think it's going to taste like scrambled eggs.
Right.
It doesn't. Even if you use a whole egg, all it gives it is a creamy consistency. It's a frothing effect. It's a creamy consistency. It doesn't taste like egg. It just does good things.
It's an ingredient. Just like any of the other ingredients you're putting in, it should marry with what you're putting into it.
And a lot of these classic cocktails, it's absolutely imperative that you have it to make the real deal. Hey, we want to thank you a lot for coming on, Ted.
Absolutely.
Ted, you've been great. You got to be on the show again.
I want to.
Yeah, great. And if you're ever out in New Jersey and I find out that you were in Central Jersey and thirsty and didn't come by, I'm going to be really mad at you.
I'm going to put the guys out on me.
Yeah, exactly. Hey, thanks a lot. Again, that was Ted Haig. His book is Vintage Spirits and Forgotten Cocktails. You can go pick it up. You can find out how to do that linking right through our website at restaurantguysradio.com. Hope you've enjoyed the hour listening to us babble on about the cocktail. Hey, Mark, let's go get a drink.
I'm thirsty.
I'm Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascoe.
We are the Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. Time is 12 noon.